All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I was an Army aviator in back in Vietnam. Holy mackerel, that's decades ago now. Well, I want to welcome you to our program. I'm really excited to have our guest, our Rebecca Grant, who is our foreign affairs expert. She will be up first. And then we've got Mark Liebman, who is an author of a number of different books about Navy helicopter pilots, actually. So a lot of rotorhead talk today on the program. So we want to make sure that you stick around. If you do have any questions for us, give us a call here at Veterans Radio. The number is 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600. Before we get into the program, though, I got to make sure I thank our sponsors because we couldn't do it without their support. So number one on the list is Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans specializes in veterans disability claims. You can give them a call at 800-693-4800, or you can go to their website. That's legalhelpforveterans.com. Number two is National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, and it is the nation's largest third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses. You want to do business with the government or many corporations as a veteran-owned business, you got to get certified, and these are the folks that can do it for you. For more information, you can go to their website, that's nvbdc.org, or give them a call at 888-237-8433. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For more information, you can go to va.gov/Ann Arbor Healthcare. And the American Legion Post 46 out of Ann Arbor, that's the Irwin Prescorn American Legion Post. We want to thank them for their support of Veterans Radio. If you'd like to help out and support us, just go to veteransradio.net/our sponsors, and we've got all kinds of information there where you can help us out. I should remind everyone that Veterans Radio is a nonprofit organization, 501c3, so we will be more than happy to accept your donations if you feel like it. If you like what we're doing, please support us. One event that's coming up out of many, I'm sure, across the country, but this one is local, and it is the U.S. Hockey and Region 9 Veteran Community Action Team invite all of the military members in Southeast Michigan to come out to their military appreciation night. Boy, my mouth is not working well today. Anyway, military appreciation night, and it's going to be the weekend of March 18th, 19th, and 20th, and it's free for all you veterans out there. All you have to do is go to their website, and you can get the information to register. You need to register by the 12th of March to get free parking and a lot of other little goodies that go along with it. And you can find out more information about the event on our website, veteransradio.net. Just click on the big picture of the Military Appreciation Night there, and you could find out what it takes to get those free tickets. And where it's going to be, it's on Beck Road in Plymouth, Michigan, off of M14. And we, Veterans Radio, is going to be there on that Sunday doing our broadcast live from U.S. Hockey. So that should be pretty exciting. We're really looking forward to that. We haven't been out on the road in over 2 years. So we're excited. So we check out it on our website. That's Military Appreciation Weekend. And that's at the U.S. Hockey Arena in Plymouth, Michigan. Okay. Takes care of that. All right. So let's get right into this. With the news that's going on around the world today, and especially in the Ukraine, we decided we better get our expert on. So joining me on the line is our resident expert, Dr. Rebecca Grant. Let me give her a real quick background on her. She is the president of IRIS Independent Research, which is a small woman-owned business specializing in defense and aerospace research and consulting. She has been seen, if you've been watching lately, talking about the Ukraine. She has been on Fox News, Fox Business, Smithsonian, and is a very frequent guest here on Veterans Radio. And so it is my pleasure to introduce our audience to Dr. Rebecca Grant one more time. Good evening, Dr. Grant.
Hi, Dale. It's good to be with you again, talking about these just incredible events going on with Russia and Ukraine. Wow.
I know. What is he thinking?
That's the question that a lot of Putin's oligarch friends started asking this week after the European Union and now the U.S. as well is seizing their yachts and freezing their assets. What is he thinking? One thing that's really clear out of this is this war was Putin's idea, and he is the only one who wants this war going forward. It is just shocking. You know, every day I think it can't be more surprising, and then it is, right?
Right.
So it's just just unbelievable. A great thing I think that's come out of it is, 10 days ago, to most Americans, I think Ukraine was a place far, far, far away. And now through the tremendous leadership of Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, we see a really heroic country that wants to be a democracy fighting off Russia. And frankly, their battle against Russia is going to shape our security environment for Americans for many years to come.
I couldn't agree with you. What do you think that Putin's plan is?
Well, no one knows what his plan is, but I think that Putin wants one of two things. He either wants to catch Zelensky, or he wants to take the capital city of Kyiv. You know, when you look back over the last 3 years or so, Zelensky was elected in 2019. As everyone knows now, he was an actor. He came from comedy, and he was elected to try to bring peace to Ukraine. He's turned into a fantastic leader. He's always been very oriented towards the West, wanting to pursue getting Ukraine into the European Union and perhaps ultimately into NATO. And I think for Putin, the rise of Zelensky was just something that Putin couldn't stand. He couldn't stand to see his success and this wonderful, flourishing, country becoming a real democracy, down there right on Russia's border. So I think Putin has said that his goal is to change the regime. He's leveled all these ridiculous charges about Nazis in Ukraine and all sorts of other stuff that's just not true, real just ranting and delusional. So he wants the Zelensky government out. If he can't have that, I think he wants to take the city of Kyiv. And it reminds me, Dale, of the way that the Russians took Berlin in World War II. They were our allies then, and we wanted them to do it, but it was just a bloody, bloody battle. And I think that Putin is very battle-fixated, and he wants to see his Russian Federation flag flying over the capital of Ukraine.
I can't even imagine what is going on with the people of Ukraine, what they're thinking. And, of course, the rest of the world is I don't know, flabbergasted, I guess, would be for lack of a better term. And we're trying to figure out what to do with this guy. And it seems to me, and I am no expert, obviously, about Russian history and the Soviet Union and so on, but it just seems like he wants to go back to the 1950s and start all over again.
He does. And, no one knows quite what to make of him. He's put out some incredible ideas. He blames Vladimir Lenin. Remember Lenin? He's the one who led the Bolshevik Revolution 100 years ago. He says it's Lenin's fault that Ukraine ever became a separate republic within the Soviet Union. Putin has complained about Khrushchev, and that's now the 1950s, where Khrushchev gave Crimea to Ukraine. The propaganda papers that Putin has authored and put out, it's just bone-chilling, and you don't have any idea what to do. There is, of course, a lot of talk about whether the Putin of 2022 is really rational or not. World leaders who've met with him say that he just doesn't seem to be the same, and honestly, I think he is far, far crazier than we realized.
I'm afraid I have to agree with you. We're trying to figure out what we can do, as far as our solution to this problem is. I mean, we can throw all those sanctions out there, which they have done. And in fact, I just heard, a little news clip before we came on the air of saying, of course, the sanctions are going to cost us Americans some money because it's going to increase the price of gas. We've already seen that in probably all of our local areas where it's up a dollar or getting close to $4 and $5 a gallon, which seems to me to be kind of a small price to pay if we can actually help the Ukrainians fight back against this guy.
Right. And let's start with the security assistance that it looks like Congress is going to provide. You know, we've provided about $3 billion worth of assistance to Ukraine since 2014, 2015. That's all been spent. And most of it was spent on training Ukraine's armed forces. And wow, they are doing a terrific job. Ukraine is really doing well at fighting back. And so I think that investment in training has absolutely paid off. And I'm talking about, for example, we had Americans, also British and Canadian military members go over to Ukraine for exercises before the war, and they trained them on how to fire a Javelin missile. They trained them on how to call in airstrikes. And they did other very basic and important training at their NCO academies. They trained them in, you know, in small arms marksmanship, all sorts of things to make it a more professional force. And that was part of that original $3 billion. We've seen an emergency $350 million that was authorized in February. That's mostly been drawn down now to top up their stocks of Javelins and Stinger missiles and other things. And then the Senate, actually it was Senator Chris Coons, a Democrat, who initially proposed a figure of $10 billion. I expect the Senate's going to approve something real close to that to continue to provide security assistance. And hey, I get it, $10 billion's a lot of money. But do remember, our own defense budget annually is over $700 billion. So any money we send right now directly to Ukraine's military is a great investment in America's security. As for the gas prices and oil and energy, I mean, heck, it was going up to start with. But that question about what to do with the Russian energy sector is really important. And, hey, like you, I mean, it just ticked over to $4 at the pump, you know, a half mile from my house. And I know it's higher in other places in the United States, and that's a tax on us. That's pretty scary. But I'm so curious as to why we are still not putting any sanctions on the Russian energy sector.
That's true. That is true. I mean, just shut it down.
You know, I think
it's the just personal opinion. We're talking here with Dr. Rebecca Grant, who's our foreign affairs expert. And I'm just questioning if the current administration should just open up our pipelines. I mean, I know it's going to offend the environmentalists out there and so forth, but so many of those environmentalists are never going to vote for the other party anyway, even if they don't, you know, don't get their way. But I'm just thinking, you know, if we have enough oil here and in Canada and stuff to take care of our own needs, then we can shut them down, couldn't we?
Yes, that would be very helpful. And I care about the environment, too. I know everyone does. But in the case of the Keystone XL pipeline, you know, there's already a pipeline there. This is just adding to what's there. It's like literally right next to it. We ought to open up all of our production. And then, you know, let me quote the U.S. Treasury Department. They've done a great job in putting on the sanctions on the oligarchs and in some other things, but right now, under our official U.S. policy, there is no restriction on the sale, purchase, or transportation of Russian oil and gas. Now, when you think that Russian oil and gas accounts for about half of their exports, remember, Russia's economy is really tiny. It's actually smaller than Canada's. And oil and gas and some other mineral products are their number one export, and they just are a huge part of their economy. So we haven't even tried to shut that down. I understand oil is a commodity. It's traded on the world market. But I think our Treasury Department is smart enough to be able to go after some of that Russian gas and oil, and it's really time to do it.
I think so. I really think that the country would unite behind that decision to do that, to do anything that we can to just shut down their economy entirely. And I think that, you know, you might get into a situation where the people of Russia might actually rise up and say, hey, enough of this. I mean, it's already bad enough for their oligarchs whose, you know, boats are being taken and their planes and so on and so forth. But, I mean, the people in Russia themselves are going to eventually be suffering from all of these sanctions.
Yeah, pretty soon, I think. Take the example of Global Aviation. Their airline Aeroflot has been thrown out. But it's more than that. Companies like Boeing and the European Airbus have said, hey, we're not going to send you any more spare parts for your planes. no more access to the online tech data that you need to do regular maintenance and repair. So it's not only just closing the airspace, and so that means, hey, no flights to Miami, no going to Cancun, no going anywhere. That's immediately going to start to affect Russia. I want to see FedEx stop deliveries. I think they're considering it. And then we've seen Visa and MasterCard decide not to to do business there anymore. Now, Putin had prepared for this to some extent. Most Russians have kind of an internal Russian bank debit card, so they can go on for a while, and don't underestimate the Russians. They're very tough people. I don't know if the sanctions will get to the Russian people quick enough to affect Putin, but it's something that we have to do. And I think, Dale, the larger question for all that we want to do sanctions is, are we going to let Russia win in Ukraine or not? That's the question we're going to have to start asking ourselves.
And that's my next question. So what do you think that NATO can actually do to push back without, I mean, there certainly is going to be the fear that, you know, he's got atomic bombs and all kinds of nuclear weapons out there. And I think that's obviously the fear.
Yes, and NATO is, you know, NATO has done a pretty good job, but I think there's just three big obstacles. One is keeping the alliance together. And you're talking 30 countries, and they are going to all know 30 people are going to agree on anything. Same with NATO. They don't always agree on everything, and we want that coalition to hold together more than anything. There is a real concern about nuclear war. I think Putin is really playing on that right now, and I think Putin is doing nuclear blackmail, and he knows that that's something that can really, really scare NATO. And remember, Putin hates NATO, and one of his goals is to break it up. He demanded that the alliance throw out everyone who joined since 1997, which is the entire eastern flank. You know, it's 14 countries. Not going to happen. So I think that's been a problem. And then here's the other problem. U.S. leadership hasn't been what it should be. You know, NATO was founded with the idea that the U.S. would lead. General Dwight Eisenhower went back into uniform to be the first head of NATO back when it was formed back in 1949, 1950. And without the strong U.S. leadership, you know, Biden decided he wanted to do diplomacy and sanctions and ride it out that way. I think our diplomats today have forgotten that our success in the Cold War was based on using diplomacy and our military presence together. They're just not adept at that, and they have missed so many chances to help. This discussion about the no-fly zone, had they put one in place just before the invasion, would have been very different. And I know that, you know, they're afraid of the risks that they are taking, but the no-fly zone one is particularly tough because it's not like we're trying to put it in hostile airspace. You know, Ukraine has a no-fly zone. They themselves are trying to manage to keep the Russian Air Force out, and they're doing a decent job of it. We don't see the Russian Air Force flying at night very much. Most of their attacks have been very close to their border, and right now Ukraine does have fighter jets and the surface-to-air missiles that are still functioning, and they have command and control. Now, the U.S. has helped them, and others have helped them with that over time, done some training. But, you know, the idea that NATO wouldn't even keep the threat of a no-fly zone, I mean, Zelensky was really upset, and I understand. It's kind of like Zelensky said, hey, I need a no-fly zone, and NATO said, hey, good work, you know, keep up the good work, but we can't really help you. We'll send you supplies. We'll shovel in things from Poland, but we won't even threaten a no-fly zone. And that goes to the issue of these two things, the concern about the Russian nuclear threats, and I think the concern about whether Putin is a little off his rocker, right? So for all those reasons, NATO is just super reluctant. But here's the thing. If Russia is triumphant in Ukraine, then do we have this discussion about a NATO member? Let's pick one. How about Lithuania? What if Putin wants to go into Lithuania? Do we have that same discussion of, gee, I don't know, nuclear threats, and we're not sure what we want to do? You know, I think it's really critical for NATO to make sure that Ukraine wins this war.
Well, I agree. I mean, I didn't even know where Ukraine was, other than when we have talked in the past, and we talked about Crimea being on the Black Sea, and I'm going, oh, I know where that is. And I think that that's one of the things, as you mentioned earlier on, it's just, you know, this is so far away, but it is affecting us right now, you know, just around the corner. And I think the idea of NATO, I think that they have to threaten with a no-fly zone, personally. I also think I was very curious today in an article that I saw about the Israelis being involved in a little bit of trying to negotiate some sort of settlement. Are you familiar with that?
You know, several countries have offered to step in, including Turkey. So there's quite a mix of people who are willing to go talk. And, of course, France and Germany, with their new chancellor, Olaf Scholz, are on the phone with Putin pretty regularly. And Zelensky himself has offered peace talks. So there's no shortage of folks who are willing to talk. And if the Israelis or somebody, anyone can pull it off, I think that's great. I do want to share some good news about what Poland is doing, if we have time.
We sure do. Go ahead.
Right. So, you know, Poland has become what I think back in our day they always thought of Germany and the inner German border. Well, that border now really is with Poland. And as Belarus, what we would have called Belarusia, which is up there north of Ukraine, has become basically a Soviet satellite, right? It's a total extension of Putin now. Remember, he put forces in Belarus to be able to go down and invade into Ukraine, and their leader, Lukashenko, is completely at his beck and call. So that means that this is such a map here, but Poland has a long border with Belarus, and that means basically Poland is practically, you know, facing down Russia right now. We have had a pretty big army presence in Poland for the last several years. We have typically 5,000 U.S. forces there. We're now up to 10,000 forces. And the Poles have been very stalwart in facing the threat. And right now, the U.S. State Department is working on a deal with Poland where Poland will take its MiG-29 fighters. This is a real nice, really the last of the great, really slick Cold War fighters. Poland kept them after the Iron Curtain fell, right? And they fly their MiG-29s. They're updated. They want to give their 28 MiG-29s to Ukraine's Air Force, because Ukraine operates that type as well. So they can bring them in to fill out Ukraine's Air Force and have the same maintenance and pilots and, you know, get all that technical aspects worked out. In return, the State Department is looking at giving U.S. F-16 fighters. And, of course, Poland will be buying the new stealth F-35 fighter. They're in line to do that. I think this is a great idea. I mean, I'd rather see NATO go in and just say, to heck with it, let's set up a no-fly zone and have this out now, you know. But the fact that our ally Poland is willing to send its own Air Force for the Ukrainians to fly and use tells you how seriously they take this. And I think that's kind of the level of seriousness that we need, because it is essential to stop Russia here. Russia's military forces, I never underestimate them, but there are all sorts of questions about their morale. They've had a few generals killed. You've got to wonder what these Russian commanders are thinking at this point. And I think a strong show and more direct military support from the West can make sure that Putin does not win this one.
No, we can't afford to let that happen. That's for darn sure. I mean, this is kind of reminiscent of Hitler, you know, going into Sudetenland. Oh, there's Germans in here and there's Germans in there, and so we're just coming in to protect the Germans. And this is just a repeat, you know, and now he's just trying to protect the Russians that are, you know, in these countries that are, you know, as he's talks about them as being, you know, part of Russia historically, and they should always be part of Russia, which is, before I can get totally carried away with that. So where do you see this going in the next week or two?
I think that as you look at the map, there are Russian forces getting closer to Kyiv. We know that the Russian forces fighting in the south along the Black Sea ports from Odessa to Kherson and Mariupol have done pretty well. Of course, they have all of Crimea there as a support, so it wasn't that hard, right, for them to be able to fight pretty well there. And then up north, you know, directly quite some distance north is Kyiv, and you see the forces starting to come in and come down and more shelling taking place in Kyiv. So I think that Putin tries to move on Kyiv. Very interesting, as soon as his forces move a bit more, of course, he's vulnerable. And here comes the no-fly zone again. They're very vulnerable to air attack. And your military perspective, you look at this map, you look at those vehicles on the highway, and you think, oh, they would be so easy to stop. But Ukrainians are also pretty good with the javelins and their other ways of fighting. They can move on the Russian forces coming in. And I think that the Ukrainians will fight even if Kyiv gets encircled. So that's what I'm watching for this week, to see whether the Russians really continue their move on Kyiv, and if they continue this to shell the other cities that they are investing. They're really also trying to get in there to Kharkiv as well, and that's pretty close to the Russian border, so they're unfortunately making decent progress. We've got to see Ukraine hold out and, of course, keep the western part of Ukraine open so that U.S. and NATO supplies can continue to get. I noted that there are over a dozen countries that are helping to move the supplies in, I imagine both by rail and road and probably into some of the airfields in the west. So we got to keep the western supply routes open and watch for that encirclement of Kyiv to really pick up steam.
Well, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in the next couple of weeks. And Dr. Grant, I want to thank you so much for being on Veterans Radio again. And let us know. And then, you know, when something's breaking, please let us know and we'll get you back on the air as soon as we can. Thank you very much, Dr. Grant.
Thank you for inviting me. And let's stand with Ukraine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
All right. I don't know if we know anything new. I think we probably know a lot more information than we did in the past. And I think it's very helpful for all of us to try and understand what is actually going on in the Ukraine. You know, considering all of the sources of news that are flying around out there, we thought it would be important to bring in what we feel is one of the most reputable and most understandable explanation of what is going on. All right, so we're going to take a real quick break, and when we come back, our next guest is Mark Liebman, and Mark is a Navy aviator, so I think we're going to be talking a little bit about aviation a little bit in the next part of Veterans Radio. So come on around after the break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Marine Corps Sergeant Daniel Matthews became a one-man army before being killed. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Participating in a counterattack against a firmly entrenched and well-concealed North Vietnamese force, Matthews fearlessly advanced in the attack until his squad was pinned down by a murderous sweep of fire from an enemy machine gun. Observing that the deadly fire prevented a corpsman from removing a wounded man in an open area, Matthews worked his way to the base of the hostile machine gun emplacement, leaped onto the rock formation surrounding the gun, and single-handedly charged the hostile emplacement with his rifle. Although severely wounded when the enemy brought a withering hail of fire to bear upon him, he continued his one-man assault, and firing his rifle with deadly effectiveness, succeeded in killing two of the enemy, routing a third, and completely silencing the enemy weapon, thereby enabling his comrades to evacuate the stricken Marine to a safe position. Matthews succumbed to his wounds before aid could reach him.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit VeteransCrisisLine.net. VeteransCrisisLine.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio, and my guest for this portion of the program is Mark Liebman, and let me give you a little background on this guy. He's a retired Navy captain, began his naval career back in 1968, and was a naval aviator. This is where we get into the good stuff. And during his active duty career, he made deployments to Vietnam, the Mediterranean, as well as Persian Gulf, Norwegian, and Black Seas. Combat veteran of Vietnam and Desert Shield, Desert Storm. Flew helicopters on combat search and rescue missions, special operations missions, anti-submarine warfare, and logistics. Whew, that's a lot of flying. When he retired, he had just under 5,000 hours of pilot flight time. A little bit more than mine. I only had 2,000. And he started.
He won't hold that against you.
And he started writing books. And the reason that I wanted to bring Mark on is that I got one of his books called Big Mother 40, which is a Vietnam War novel. And he talks all about helicopters in there. So I want everybody in the Veterans Radio audience to meet our guest today, Mark Liebman. Mark, welcome to Veterans Radio.
It's an honor to be here. And hopefully this will be we'll have a fun conversation.
It should be. Not quite as serious as the last one we had in the first half of the program. So tell me, how did you get involved or what was your decision of going into the Navy? I want to talk about a little bit about your career first.
Well, it's pretty simple. My father was a career Air Force pilot. I've always wanted to be a military pilot, and the Navy was willing to guarantee me flight training. The Air Force said, no, once you get a commission, we'll figure out what we're going to do with you. The Navy said, pass the physical and the mental tests, and we'll let you be a Navy. And obviously, if you get through the training program, you can be a naval aviator. Plus the fact I like ships, but the primary reason I went into the Navy was because it would guarantee me flight training.
And what kind of flight training did you get? I'm not that familiar with Navy flight training.
Okay, it's evolved since then. So I entered flight training in 1968, in June of 68. And at the time, what the Navy did is send everybody, helicopter, jet drivers, multi-engine guys, through the same basic program until you got to primary, or at least primary. So we all flew T-34, soloed, and some of the guys went jets. At the time there, I went through there having problems with the jets and the basic phase. So they sent us all to VT-2. I flew the T-28, went out and landed on a boat, hoped I was going to go fly jets. And the Navy said, well, guess what? We need 25 helicopter pilots. So I became a helicopter pilot, and then I went for VT-2. There's a couple different squadrons, and then I wound up at Ellison Field at HT-8 and became a designated Navy helicopter pilot. But the big thing about the Navy flight training program back then and to this day is everybody learns to fly fixed wing, and then they start splitting you off later on. It's a little different now, but that's...
Okay, so where did you do this flight training, your initial...
Pensacola, Florida.
Now, see, I can say I've been to Pensacola. We used to fly down to Pensacola from Fort Rucker to work with the SEALs.
Yep. Well, we went to Fort Rucker several times to go learn how to fly Hueys, because I was in the first group of Navy helo drivers that learned to fly. We went from the Bell Jet Ranger to the Huey. They were phasing out the H-34s. And we went to Corpus Christi to go pick up helicopters there that were tired and Vietnam vets. We flew them back, but a couple of us took cross countries to go to Dothan, which is Fort Rucker.
Dothan. So you were in, what was your assignment over there?
Well, initially I went over there to fly search and rescue, and we operated off carriers as well as destroyers and cruisers. Again, the designations have changed. If I use DLG, nobody would know what the heck that was. So a DLG is just a large destroyer with a flight deck on the back. And then we operated off carriers, primarily off Yankee Station, but then we had destroyers off the coast of North Vietnam, pretty close to Haiphong, and then that was known as North Sar. And then there was one south off in the vicinity of Vien known as South Sar. And we had a helo debt on each one. Depending on what helicopter was in the debt, they either stood 2-minute alert or they launched in orbit off the coast of Vietnam to provide rescue services in case somebody got shot down.
Okay. And I just got cut off for a moment there. Thank you. I figured you could just keep talking about what you knew. And okay, yeah, because we flew some of those missions too. We flew a special force. I got to actually land on, I guess it was a destroyer. I didn't know what it was. I just remember landing on this little pad in the back of a ship that kept going up and down as we were trying to land on it. And I said, well, I'll just leave this to the Navy.
Well, let me tell you something about landing on the back end of a destroyer. It's the ultimate confined area because it moves up and down and pitches and rolls. And I've landed on I actually landed on a Norwegian frigate that was, the deck was going up about 20, 30 feet, up and down 20, 30 feet. And this was in the Barents and was rolling 15 to 20 degrees. And the only reason we had to land is we were going to pick up a young seaman who had been seriously injured. And he was in we had to put him in what's known as a Stokes litter, which is like a stretcher that's got wire frame on it, because he had IVs hanging from his body.
Oh, geez.
And there's no way we were going to try to hoist him aboard. But yeah, and by the way, the rotor tip to superstructure clearance was less than a foot.
That's like landing in the jungle, you know?
Yeah, that's what I said. It's the ultimate confined area.
You know, they told me I put my tail rotor down in the fork of a tree one time. So we survived.
I never did that.
But, I just wanted to let our audience know that you know what you're talking about. Because now let's talking about your writing career. How did that start up?
Not well. I read Red Storm Rising and then Flight of the Intruder and Clancy's first book,
Red October.
For Red October. Yep. And I thought I could do that. And that was in the late 80s, and I wrote a book and it was terrible. I'd done a lot of freelance writing, but this, even I knew it was bad, and I was the author. So that was, I tried again in the early 90s again, and it wasn't really good. So I worked because I was traveling a lot, and also writing a lot, because as a consultant, you wind up writing white papers and proposals and presentations and blah, 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 blah. Anyway. So fast forward to 2006, 2007, I wrote a book that ultimately became Big Mother 40. Now, again, I had written freelance stuff for defense publications. I sent it off to a couple of them and said, hey, what do you think? And they went, great book. Go find a publisher. Or actually, go find an agent. Go find a publisher. So that was I won't get into that whole story. But ultimately, the publisher that published it said, this is a really great book. I really like it, but it's really two books. So we chopped off the front, which wound up at the time would be about 60,000 words. And we had the second half, which is Big Mother 40, was actually much easier to get to a finished product. And then I went back and I added a little bit to the front and a little bit to the back of what's that became Cherubs 2. And so that's how so that one came out in September 2012, that being Big Mother 40. And by the spring of that year, it was an Amazon bestseller, had won a couple of awards. And then June of 2013, it was voted as one of the top 100 military novels of all time, which I thought was just astounding, because what the heck did I know? But anyway, so that's the story of Big Mother 40. And then Cherubs 2 came out a year later. And it's really the first book in the Josh Homan series in terms of chronology.
So let's talk a little bit about Josh. Is there a little autobiographical, running through this story?
Yes. I tell people Josh Homan is my Walter Mitty, if you know who Walter Mitty is.
Yes, I do.
So I changed the names, changed the dates. I changed a lot of the events for two reasons. One, to protect the innocent and keep from getting sued, but also to get it through the censors. Because of the levels of clearances I had, even though I'm a retiree, I thought it was smart to send it through the Navy to get it blessed. Mm-hmm. And by the way, my publisher is a former Royal Army, British Army SAS officer. And he said, I'm not publishing this until you get that approval.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah. And so we did that. And so the plot is fictitious. What I did is I took a lot of knowledge about what we did and how we did it and put it in the book. And some people say that Big Mother 40 is a primer on how to fly combat search and rescue and special operations missions. And it may be. It wasn't intended that way. But that's... that's how it turned out.
Well, I could certainly relate to a lot of the stories in there, even before he got in country, could relate to a few of those too, which were interesting. Let's put it that way. I encourage people to read this book. I mean, it's got so much information in it that it's you know, especially because my unit was responsible for flying many special forces missions into Cambodia and so forth. And, you know, looking at the different techniques that we used and, you know, some of the way that our missions were run, and, you know, this gun support and all these other things was really kind of taking me back in time. And so I truly enjoyed the story. And you made it about helicopter pilots instead of jet jockeys, which is always kind of one of my favorites, because they always seem to get all the big, you know, all the good ink anyway.
Yeah, what I tell people is the jet drivers get all the glory as they smoke along at 400 plus knots and dropping bombs from 10,000 or 30,000 feet. We, the rubberheads, do all the dirty work. We're down in the weeds, literally. And the big difference is they see the tracers arcing up towards them, and they get 3 or 4 seconds of the missile contrail to dodge it. And they've got all kinds of Gucci gear to foil the missile. We're down in the weeds, and you can see the muzzle flashes of the guys shooting at you. And that is the big difference. And it's not just big calibers. It's any caliber the bad guy's got. And I was listening to the lady speaking before. There's a video out. It was on Fox News that has a picture of a Soviet Mi-24 getting shot down by a Stinger. Mm-hmm. That was a pretty sobering photograph or a sequence to a rotor head.
And I think we've probably both witnessed things like that, and it's just terrifying when you think about it. And my comment always to the jet jockeys is you can go as fast as you want, but you can't stop and you can't go backwards and you can't go side to side and all these other things. And
the SA-7 was just coming into the North Vietnamese inventory when I was in Vietnam, and we had no defense against it. We didn't have chaff, we didn't have flares, but some guy figured out that the missile couldn't track you if you were below 70 knots. So if one was fired at us, we called it a quick stop and pray.
Mm-hmm.
Because number one, the missile can't turn that sharp unless it's, you know, ways away. And number two, if the computer software doesn't, it can't deal with a stationary object, so to speak, then it's going to go stupid and go right on past you. There are indications that it is, that's exactly what happened. I can't talk about that, but apparently it was an effective tactic.
I can't talk about it either. So moving on. I think even 45 years, no, 50, many years later.
If you sign one of those sheets that said TS and there were code words after that, you can't talk about it.
I can never tell anybody what happened. Otherwise, I have to kill him. And I don't want to do that. So Josh Hammond is quite the character. And as you mentioned, in the Big Mother 40, gets himself in and out of a whole bunch of events. Tell us a little bit about some of the other books in that particular series. And then just to warn you, I want to talk about your other series that are going as well.
Sure. So let me give you a quick elevator speech on the 7 books of the series, with the exception of, I'll do Big Mother 40. But so it starts with Cherubs 2. Essentially, it's how Josh Hammond gets in the special ops business. And I built around the current events of the time. So this is 1970. So there's protests in the U.S. And, oh, by the way, the U.S. Encrypted communications are being read by the Soviets, thanks to John Walker. That theme, by the way, keeps going in Big Mother 40, which is about a secret missile base in North Vietnam that's shooting down U.S. Air Force airplanes. As a Soviet commander of the base who was sent there to test tactics. You got a Vietnamese commander who's there to run the base, and they're in conflict because their governments are telling them to do different things. The North Vietnamese want to shoot down lots of airplanes. The Soviets don't want to give away the store in terms of tactics and sensors. So then the next one is Render Harmless. And it's about Nazis who want to create a Fourth Reich in West Germany in 1976. So you get to meet a Luftwaffe pilot who loses his moral compass. Who never loses his love for Adolf Hitler, a German paratrooper who loses his moral compass. And you got an SS officer plus the good guys hunting for the terrorists. That's followed by a book called Forgotten, which is about 6 American POWs who don't come home at the end of the Vietnam War. They're held by a drug lord in North Vietnam who's posing as a lieutenant colonel because he's got family connections. When they're finally rescued in 1982 and brought back to the United States, there are people in the U.S. who want them dead for a variety of reasons. That's followed by a book called Inner Look. It's about a young woman, a young girl who comes to the United States from Argentina. She has an unhappy life. Her mother dies at an early age. Her husband's killed in Korea. Her father dies of a heart attack. Her son is killed in Vietnam. She's working for CIA and besides become a spy. The Soviets want to extract her because she's at the director level, which is one level below the head shed, so to speak. And the good guys are trying to find her. And then the next one after that's Moscow Airlift, which is based on the Soviet Union coming apart in 91. It's actually a true story. I witnessed it because I was working on the other end of the Soviet Union. But the Soviet Union's run is broke. There's a plebiscite that says that we want to break up the Soviet Union. There's a coup in August of 91. There's a couple other events that happened. But anyway, so the good guys are sending Josh Hayman to Moscow as a new set of eyes, because nobody, and I can tell you this from reading the intelligence reports from June, July, August, September, we didn't have a clue what was going on. And I don't think the Brits did. I don't think the French did. And in fact, today, having read a lot about that, I don't think the KGB knew either. And that's the last book in the series is the Simisher Island incident. It takes place off the coast of North Korea. And you have Korean generals who are selling drugs with the help of the Korean premier, which in those days was Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-il. No, Kim Jong-un. And they lease the Soviet island of Simisher to set up a drug facility out of the prying eyes of the U.S. So you got drugs, you got North Koreans violating international law on Soviet territory, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the Josh Hayman series. It ends with a pretty interesting naval battle that damn near happened several times during my experience in the Pacific.
Okay. Well, we're talking with Mark Liebman here, who's written a whole series of books, and you don't have to read them in any order. You can just pick up one of the Josh Hayman series, and he does a good job of introducing the character, and the next thing you know, you're off on this adventure. And which is great about books is that you can go wherever you want to, and you have a very vivid imagination, and a lot of it's based on facts, which is frightening when you read his stories and you know that there's a tinge of truth to them. You go, oh my God, I am glad that I was a little bit ignorant at that point in time.
Well, let me share something. I pride myself in being operationally accurate. In other words, so the flying scenes and the weapon scenes are all accurate, are all realistic. The second thing is I put them in the correct historical context. So the events that drive them or drive the plot are real. I mean, they actually happened. And then the third thing I do is you do a fair amount of research and you start getting to understand the people who are making the news, so to speak. So, yeah, it's fun.
I can only imagine. I think it's exciting. It's exciting to read for all of you out there, military and civilian alike. I think you would really enjoy these stories. So he goes into another series of books, and I just put that sheet somewhere else. But so one was about sailing. No, that was the one about the sailors in the revolution.
Yeah, there's actually two more series. So let me give you a quick précis on those. So there's an Age of Sail series that starts during the American Revolution, and it's built around two midshipmen, one Royal Navy, one Continental Navy. They start as mortal enemies. They meet when one captures the other, and they become friends because they have pretty much identical backgrounds and a lot in common. So then they separate. Now they're mortal enemies. So the first two books in the series, Raider of the Scottish Coast and Carronade, are out. The third one, Death of a Lady, will be out sometime this summer. And so it's going to progress up through right around the War of 1812. But it's what they call an Age of Sail series. And so that's that series. And by the way, Raider of the Scottish Coast became a Amazon bestseller within a few months of it coming out, which totally blew me away. My publisher asked me to write an Age of Sail series. And I said, of course. But anyway,
why not?
And that's a whole story unto itself is how that came about. But anyway, the other series is what I call the Derek Elmer counterterrorism series. So it's envisioned as four books. The first two are out, Flight of the Pawnee and Failure to Fire. And so each one of these books is going to deal with a threat to the United States, to the homeland, that our intelligence communities and the media doesn't want to talk about. So Flight of the Pawnee, the elevator speech is Al-Qaeda sends somebody to the United States to kill at least 10,000 Americans in one attack. And the guy figures out how to do it. I will just merely say to you that if after you read the book, you probably don't want to go to a sporting event or a rock concert if there's an open roof.
That's like Black Sunday.
Sort of, but but it's
scarier.
Deadlier. And then Failure to Fire is about the threat. We were talking about this earlier about man pads. So Al-Qaeda sends a team of the United States to shut down the U.S. air transportation system using man pads or man portable air defense systems, these shoulder fired missiles. And I'm working on the third one right now, which is probably going to be called Insidious Dragon. And it's about a bio warfare attack on the U.S. And then the fourth one I've got an idea. But the idea I had originally had, I think I'm going to toss aside. But anyway, so again, these things are based on fact. There's a lot of operational art in them. And oh, by the way, Failure to Fire came out on February 22nd. Around the 1st of February, Federal Express announced that it had applied to the FAA to put defense countermeasure systems on all its airplanes. And I thought that was kind of interesting. I can give you the background on that, how that came about, if you want.
No, I do, because I just, all of this information that Mark is talking about, this guy is a fountain of information, is on his website. And I would strongly suggest that you go there, because that's where I said, I read that article. That's probably where I went it. And so we will talk about the FedEx airplanes actually wanted to get like chafe or whatever it is that they drop, you know, to prevent rockets from hitting them. And I thought that was really, really interesting.
So let me give you a bit of history.
I got this much time.
40 seconds or 4 minutes?
4 minutes.
Okay, I can do it in less than 4 minutes.
Okay.
So there's been about 60 attacks by shoulder or man, let's call them man pads, what they are, on commercial aircraft. That's corporate jets, airliners, and air freighters. In 2008, the U.S. government conducted a program, a series of tests, of which FedEx was one of the players. They actually put these systems on the airplanes. They worked. The only airline in the world that has these systems, defensive systems, I'll talk about in a second, is El Al. And what it is, it's called a DIRCM, Direct Infrared Countermeasure System. It's a combination of infrared sensors and lasers. So what happens is it detects the plume of a missile and it points the laser at the plume. The laser confuses the seeker head. And if it's strong enough and burns on it long enough, it actually causes the missile to come apart. But the most important thing is it causes it to go stupid and not hit the airliner. So FedEx has had, DHL has had one of its airliners shot down. It actually shot at a crash landed. FedEx the same way. And so that's what the background of it. And what's interesting is that from a cost perspective for a passenger, this study, and these are 2008 numbers, it costs for a 3-hour flight, 150-seat airplane, about 30 cents a passenger. In other words, nothing.
That's well worth it. The last thing I wanted to end up on with Mark Liebman that we've been talking to, again, go to his website, markliebman.com, is that the heroes, except for the sales series, are all helicopter pilots. And I thought it was cute because there's an explanation in the Derek Elmer books, why did you choose helicopter pilots? And the idea was always assume the bad guys are smarter than you. You'll live longer by being sneaky and stealthy than if you're brave and bold. Be unpredictable. Always have more than one viable alternative than the bad guys. expect the unexpected. I sound like I'm going through flight school here. Expect the unexpected. Don't be afraid to ask for help from people who know more than you do. Plan your own missions. Don't let the above, all the power people up there above run everything, because they're not out in the middle of it.
Yeah, they're not going to risk their ass.
No, they won't do that. Anyway, I just wanted to touch on that because we're coming up to the end of the hour. Mark Lieben, thank you so very much for being on the program. I can't wait to get back in to read some more of these stories, and we'll have you back on in the future. All right.
Perfect. Thanks. It's been fun. I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Mark, very much.
All right. Cheers.
Thanks. All right. So we've got another program of Veterans Radio in the can, as they say. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today. We've got a lot of things going on in the local area. As I mentioned, the Veterans Appreciation Night at the U.S. Hockey Arena out in Plymouth, Michigan. And you can follow out and find out more about us, Veterans Radio, on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, and go to our website, veteransradio.net. We've got over 900 programs archived there, and you can find out all you want. If you want to tell your story, contact me. That's dale@veteransradio.net. And we will be there for you to answer your questions. Benefits programs comes up in about 3 weeks. So if you have any questions about benefits, we'll do that with you too. So until then, this is Dale Thrumberry with Veterans Radio. You are dismissed.